KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Josh Mealy likes maps, but not just any kind of map. Mealy lost his eyesight at the age of 4, and he's dedicated his life to creating technological tools to assist the blind. Tools like tactile maps that give blind individuals the ability to be oriented in space. The maps are specific. They tell you by touch, for example, which way the exit is at a BART station. Next on Forum, Dr. Joshua Mealy joins us to talk more about technological innovations for the blind. It's part of our first-person interview series, profiling people who make the Bay Area unique. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. What makes the world accessible? Much has been done in recent decades to improve accessibility for those with disabilities. 20 years ago, Congress passed the Americans with Disability Act, the ADA. And signs of improvement from curb cuts to braille indicators on elevators are all around us. But let's say you're blind and you get off at the Powell Street BART stop. How do you know where to head for the exit? That's where Dr. Joshua Mealy and his colleagues at the Smith Kettlewell Eye Research Institute come in. Mealy has been blind since the age of 4, and today he's focused on creating technological tools that will make accessibility more than just an add-on to an elevator. Things like tactile maps that allow a blind person to find that BART station exit. Josh Mealy earned his PhD at the University of California, Berkeley, and he joins us this morning as part of our first-person interview series, where we profile the leaders, innovators, and compelling individuals who make a difference in the Bay Area. Josh Mealy, good morning.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you with us. Let's begin, if we might, by talking a little bit more about that map example, and then we'll get into more of the things that you're working on in your lab. But in a way, I'm interested in talking about this because it seems so counterintuitive. You think by definition of maps being something as visual objects. Walk us through how maps are more than that, that they aren't just visual, and the ways in which they can make a difference.
That's a great way to start out, actually, because that is one of the things that that I really drum into the people that I talk to about the maps and the research that I do. The whole concept of maps and graphs and charts and diagrams, it's a lot of the time people refer to that kind of information as visual. You know, you'll show somebody a periodic table or sort of thing that's laid out in a two-dimensional format, and somebody will say, oh, it's so visual, I don't know how to describe it. And the thing about it is that it is not, in fact, visual. It's spatial. And it's just that our connection to spatial information tends to be visual because vision is such a powerful way to get at that stuff. And we, most of us, are, in fact, sighted. And, you know, a good chunk, maybe, you know, a third or so of our brain is, you know, of our cortex is devoted to visual processing, or at least is involved in visual processing. So it's not a really big surprise that we call that stuff visual information, but it's spatial. And blind people are just as capable of integrating and using spatial information as sighted people, but it needs to be represented in an appropriate way.
So say something more about spatial. If you're trying to be oriented in a place and you don't have the ability to see, how does spatial factors allow for that orientation and a sense of space and place still to take place?
So that's why maps are so so cool and so powerful for blind people because, pardon me, if you have a spatial representation that you can feel and interact with that you can't see, you're able to build an internal what the, you know, sort of nerdy scientist in me calls a cognitive map or cognitive representation. But basically what you're doing is you are building an internal view or perspective of what that space is like. And that's why maps are so great, because you can actually sit at a table and feel a tactile map and learn about a much larger space that represents. So spatial information is really just the organization, usually in two dimensions, but, you know, you could have three dimensions or whatever, of information. And the information is not just the individual pieces. The information that's conveyed is really the relationship, the spatial relationship of those different objects to one another on the page or in the real world. And so if you want to know where things are in relation to one another, using a map is really the best way to do that. Again, you know, there's all sorts of other types of spatial information, but maps are a great example.
So give us a sense of how that might work. In my BART stop example, how would a map help me, if I don't have sight, find my way to the exit?
So so as I mentioned, tactile maps and maps as used by blind people are different from visual maps. They need to be designed differently and they get used differently. And the real difference is that a tactile map is a much more effective tool for learning about a space in advance. We call this trip planning in the orientation and mobility field. Orientation and mobility is the field that basically teaches blind people how to get from one place to another, teaches them the cues, the techniques, and the basic approaches to navigating the built environment. So we use maps differently in that we don't use them to get unlost. A blind person is never going to really stand on a street corner with a tactile map and say, where the heck am I, and try to get unlost with a tactile map. Rather, you'll use it in advance. You'll say, I know I'm going to, you know, the Powell Street BART station, and I happen to have a map of the layout of the Powell Street BART station. In fact, we're working on a project that I'll describe to you, where we're designing tactile maps of the street level and of the concourse level and of the platform level for every one of the BART stations, which is a totally unique and new approach to wayfinding information for blind people.
And that's part of what you're working on as well at your lab within the Smith Kettlewell Eye Research Institute is to have sort of maps by demand, right? So that you can create these and have these printed for whichever location you're going to.
Right. So those are actually two separate projects. We have a BART maps project and we have a street maps project. And actually both of them are the Smith Kettlewell Eye Research Institute, where I work, sort of is the home of the technology for both of those. The technology was developed there, and my lab is involved in sort of perfecting and sort of doing research around those tools. The Lighthouse, the San Francisco Lighthouse that we collaborate with extensively, is the sort of the on-the-ground partner. They are – so the Street Maps project is called TMAP. It stands for Tactile Maps Automated Production. And it uses a set of GIS tools and a website to allow blind people to specify and download a file of a nicely formatted tactile map of anywhere in the U.S. and print it out on any Braille embosser, which is just a completely – new thing that is enabled by the availability of the internet and GIS information, meaning geographical information, the same kind of information that goes into Google Maps or any other online mapping tools that sighted people are familiar with. And then the embossers. So because of these three existing technologies, we were able to develop TMAP as a completely new way for blind people to get tactile street map information, whereas before that was available, some nice person would have basically had to draw you a tactile map by hand. And I'm sure you can imagine that tactile maps were quite a bit harder to come by before TMAP.
Dr. Joshua Mealy joining us this hour. Talk some, if you would, Josh, about the way in which technology, the internet that you just referenced, has really changed the landscape from perhaps the days when you were in grad school at UC Berkeley. What do you have access to now that doesn't require the sort of armload of equipment that you might have had to haul around the Berkeley campus, you know, a dozen, 15 years ago?
Yeah, right. I mean, my standard joke is, you know, you know, sort of relates to how many blind people it takes to cross a street. And it's a very tongue-in-cheek joke. But, I mean, the answer is two. It's one to push the shopping cart full of equipment and the other to ask a sighted person for help because the equipment is all broken and doesn't work. And obviously that's, you know, that's a joke. Blind people are very independent and they wouldn't need to push a shopping cart full of equipment around and they wouldn't all need to ask a sighted person for help. But with the you know, all of the different things that we need, whether it's a GPS device or a money identifier or a light probe that will tell you whether an LED is turned on or off, there are lots of different tools that we have developed for our use over the years, and each of them until now has really been its own little device that you would need to haul around if you wanted to use it. And I think that really one of the most amazing things for blind people in the last 5-10 years is consonant with one of the most amazing advances for sighted people, which is just the ridiculous capabilities built into a single smartphone. While new technologies always present new barriers for people with disabilities, they often present new opportunities. And smartphones are really one of the great examples of providing a platform for all kinds of accessibility tools and in particular, information accessibility on the go in many different respects.
I saw one yesterday that seems so obvious in a sense, but brilliant in its degree of simplicity, which was using the camera function on a smartphone that you could point at a dollar bill or a $100 bill, and then it would be voice activated because obviously those dollar bills are the same size. So it's a way of providing audio cues. And is that some of what you're trying to do in your lab, is to just come up with, well, we could do this?
Yeah, I mean, I have I'm embarrassed at how lucky I am to have the job that I do. I mean, I basically come up with cool ideas for technology to solve existing problems for blind people. And then I try to get somebody to give me money to research and develop prototypes. And then I try to work with industry to get it into people's hands. And that's I can't imagine a more sort of rewarding and admittedly, self-benefiting practice. I mean, but it's exactly what I want to be doing. And it's that's exactly what we do. We basically come up with things that need doing and figure out how to do it and then try to get it into people's hands.
Give me an example of a cool thing that you're working on right now.
There are a few different projects that I have going right now. One of them is a virtual wireless braille keyboard that we call the Wearabraille, that has, basically it's, the idea is to give you a keyboard that you can type with, but that you don't need to carry around with you. And what we're doing is to build this keyboard into a pair of gloves, and each of your fingers in these sort of, you can think of them as cycling gloves kind of with, no fingertips so that you can still handle money and you can push elevator buttons and read Braille and stuff like that. But on the knuckles of each finger has an accelerometer on it. And the accelerometer is able to know when that finger taps on a firm surface like a tabletop. So because Braille is a cording system that has to do with combinations of dots, we don't need to worry about where your fingers are or what their orientation is. All we need to know is which fingers tapped at the same time. And using wireless technology, the two gloves communicate with one another and look to the device that they're connected to, just like a Bluetooth keyboard. So basically, this virtual wireless Braille keyboard allows somebody to type text without holding a keyboard, without even holding your smartphone, and without dealing with the virtual keyboards and scrunchy keyboards that are so famous on these smartphones. So, for example, with a Bluetooth headset and the Wearabraille, you can just leave your cell phone in your pocket and do all of the texting and interacting with your GPS and emailing and making phone calls that you would need to do.
So if you wanted to send a text right now and you had this device, you could just tap it out on the desk that we're sitting in front of us, mm-hmm. and that would fire off that text?
That's exactly it. Yeah. I wouldn't need to take anything out or do anything. There is, you know, there's a command to turn on the Wear Braille, because otherwise, you know, as you sort of go through your life, you'd be sending garbage characters to your smartphone. But yeah, basically that's it.
And well, not to be greedy about it, but it also sounds like that would be applicable then to more widespread. Everyone struggles with the smartphone being able to type on that. It sounds like these are also innovations that could prove useful beyond the blind community.
And that is exactly sort of the hope always in developing these accessible technologies, which is that if you're going to make them only for blind people, then you're not going to be able to sell very many of them, and they're going to be expensive to produce. And so the hope is always that you can find a mainstream application for the devices that you do. That's one hope. And then the other hope is that you can find mainstream devices that already have functionality that you can leverage to do the things that you want to do, smartphones being an example, smart pens being another example.
Describe smart pens, and you have one with us that maybe we can demonstrate and we can get a little bit of a sense for how those actually work.
Yeah, the smart pen is something that we've been using for a couple of years now. It's an off-the-shelf product made by an Oakland company called LiveScribe, and they have a programmer's API, which basically lets you add your own apps to the pen. So the pen is basically, it's just a pen. It's got a computer inside it. It's it's got a speaker and a microphone. And the cool thing about it is that basically when you touch it to a piece of paper that is sort of specially prepared, and I don't really want to get into exactly how it works because it's complicated, but suffice it to say that the pen knows where it is on a piece of paper when it touches it, and it knows which piece of paper it is. So you can have the pen react to stuff that you touch and react specifically to the different locations.
And so it would give you the ability to, going back to the example of a map or a graph or a map of the brain or whatever, you could touch certain aspects of that and it would then give you an audio cue?
That's exactly it, yeah.
You want to demonstrate, Josh? You've got
sure.
one with us.
Yeah, and the cool thing about it is that it's small, it's portable, it's cheap. And what it does for tactile graphics is to minimize the amount of clutter in the form of labeling that you need to put on a map. So, for example, when you – that was just the pen turning on. So when you have – I'm looking right now. I have a map of the Colosseum streetscape, the streets around the Colosseum BART station. And this is part of the Oakland Colosseum. Which is the connection to the Oakland Airport and the, if you want to go to an A's game or something like that, you would go through here. And so what we show on this map is all the different bus stops and the taxi stands and, where the escalators are to go up to the overpass. But we don't have enough labeling space to indicate all of that. So, for example, I've got a symbol that's a staircase. If I tap on the staircase with
stairs up to pedestrian overpass and stadium.
So that tells me where those stairs go. Here's an elevator symbol that I can tap on.
Elevator up to pedestrian overpass and stadium.
Here's a taxi stand.
Taxi stand on the west side of San Leandro Street.
So it gives you more detail.
A lot more detail, yeah. And you can layer information. So, you could say, for example, here I'm going to tap on the bus stop.
Shuttle stop to Oakland Airport on the east side of San Leandro Street.
I could also, if I tapped again, I could, it's not in there, but if, you could program in, for example, a second layer of scheduling information. So a second tab might tell you when that shuttle was going to come.
And that's particularly important in terms of accessibility issues, because a lot of people who have a variety of disabilities, not only people who are blind, public things like public transportation are particularly key, so that if you have the ability to tap on that and say the number, 27 bus is coming in 14 minutes or whatever, it gives you that much more data.
That's right. And I mean, transit, public transit really is an essential resource for an independent blind person. And that's why we chose this project. The lighthouse and Smith Kettlewell chose this project to do, because basically it's a BART is the transit nervous system of the Bay Area. And if you want to get around, you need BART. And we thought that this was a really innovative and essential piece of the puzzle for providing access to transit, not just access to the schedule information, not just access to the overall system map of BART, but access to the street level and concourse level and platform level information about where are the stairs, where are the bus stops, where are the taxi stops.
And in a sense, the full meaning of the word access. I mean, access writ large, access to the world. I mean, being able to function in whatever way one would like to be able to function.
Yes.
I want to come back to something you were suggesting before about all of these applications can grow to have an impact and be applicable to a variety of situations. Is part of what you're wanting to push us all towards is to think about these questions from the get-go so that when someone is designing, whether it's a BART station or anything else, that these factors are all a part of it so that we build into the original construction of whether it's buildings or anything we do these various design questions?
Yeah. There's a whole design, a school of design thought called universal design, and essentially it has to do with thinking about these issues at a very early design stage, thinking about who's going to be using it, not just the average person that's going to be using it, but everybody. And the idea behind it is, of course, that that if you think carefully about all of the different types of people that are going to be using anything, whether it's a building or a piece of software or a piece of consumer electronics, by carefully designing in the all of the use cases, you will make it a better usability experience for everyone. And that's the theory. A lot of the time it works. And sometimes it's very difficult to figure out exactly how to implement that. And that's, the devil is always in the details.
Do you think that we've come some distance in the way in which we think about these things societally? I mean, we think about the landmark passage of the ADA 20 years ago. Does the internet, in a sense, is that such a game changer that we now have to think about things in a completely different way?
I don't know about the internet. As we move forward, technologically speaking, there are always new tools that provide new access solutions, and there are always new tools that provide or create access barriers. So I don't think that we're moving. We're making some advances. I'm not going to be pessimistic about it. We certainly are, but there are always areas where improvement is crucial. The thing that you mentioned about sort of the way we're thinking about these things and how that's changing, that's a societal issue. And I think that awareness of disability is definitely coming to a new place, especially with the aging population and folks coming back from wars with new disabilities.
And we'll talk more about that when we return. We have to take a short break, and we'd like you to join our conversation as well. What technological difference do you think these innovations can make? What is still needed if you are blind or are contending with a different disability? We'd like your participation in our conversation. Join us at 866-733-6786. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Dr. Joshua Mealy. He's associate scientist at the Smith Kettlewell Eye Research Institute. He joins us as part of our continuing series of first-person interviews where we talk with leaders and innovators and compelling individuals who are making a difference to life here in the Bay Area. We'd like you to join us as well if you have some thoughts on the kinds of technological needs that you think would make a difference in the life of someone who is blind. If you're blind or you're contending with a different disability, love your ideas and thoughts about what still needs to be done in terms of technological advances. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Let's hear first from Bill in Moss Beach. Bill, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I have both a brother and a sister who have RP, retinitis pigmentosa, and are blind. And so over the years that I've tried to work with them to find, you know, cost-effective technical solutions that will help them interact with their world more effectively and basically stay engaged. And the one thing that I found that really seems to make an unbelievable difference is an iPhone. The iPhone has what's called VoiceOver on it, and especially when paired with a Bluetooth keyboard, it enables them to do a whole wide variety of things and do those things pretty effectively. And the interesting thing is it's available for anybody. You just go into a Verizon store, an AT&T store, an Apple store, and if you learn how to use it, you can do anything with the iPhone that a sighted person can do.
Bill, thanks for the observation. Josh, you were mentioning that before about the sort of brilliance of the iPhone in particular. Describe how the VoiceOver system works.
Well, first of all, I am an iPhone user. I have an iPhone, and I want to sort of, you know, rather than being a big opportunity for product placement, I want to say that sort of the capabilities of smartphones, you know, Google, the Android system is catching up quickly, both in terms of I think it's, you know, it's got a huge market share now. They do have accessibility aspects on Android as well. They are not nearly as robust or well developed as the iPhone accessibility, but that, you know, those are things that are going to change. So when I talk about these things, after I tell you that Apple is to absolutely be applauded for integrating all of the accessibility solutions, not just into the iPhone operating system and the iPad, but also into all of their desktop and laptop computers. You just have to turn it on. You don't have to buy an extra piece of equipment or an extra piece of software to make it talk. So that is extraordinary and really the first time for any consumer electronics that has happened. So they deserve huge kudos for that. So, but it is pretty amazing that that this type of technology can be used by blind and visually impaired people, because, for example, the type of information it gives you access to. I use mine all the time for stuff like NextBus, so that basically if I'm standing on a street corner wondering whether I should try to catch the, you know, one California or the three, I can just look on my iPhone and see which one's going to come next and decide to wait at that stop or realize that neither one of them is going to come anytime soon and I should walk, you know, which is really gives me much more flexibility and the information that I need to get where I want to go.
I'm interested that you just use the phrase, I look at my iPhone. I always think
I
shouldn't use words like look when we're talking about this sort of...
No, it's all metaphorical.
Yeah.
Don't, you know, if you've got blind friends, don't, you know, ask them if they've heard a movie or anything like that. it's sweet of you to be sensitive, but completely unnecessary.
Jim in El Cerrito joins us next. Jim, go ahead, please.
Hey, Josh. Jim here in El Cerrito. It's a real neat surprise to hear you on, and it's so gratifying to see how where you've come from and where you are now. It's terrific.
Hi, Jim.
And I wanted to say there's some interesting stuff going on about, well, if you have, like I found out the other day, being a Dish Network user, that, and this may have happened for a long time, but a blind person may not also know what they're missing. You know, my wife was surfing through the channels, and she said, oh, this program's on channel such and such and that. I said, wait a minute. You mean to tell me that when you hit the channel up or down button, you can actually see the program on the screen that's on at that given time? And I'm saying, and she said, yeah, that's the way it goes. I'm saying, they ought to speak that, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's video accessibility is a huge area. And by the way, you know, Jim is a good friend of mine, and we've known each other for many, many years. The whole area of video accessibility is huge, and I am doing some interesting work in that. As you say, you know, the TV or, you know, whatever it is you're using, it would be great if it could speak this sort of text-based information that's popping up on the screen. But video accessibility has a lot more to it than that. There's all this stuff related to video description that is a really interesting area of very dynamic change right now. I'm working on an interesting project related to video accessibility for basically figuring out developing a platform, an internet-based platform for people anywhere to be able to describe anything and share that. So that's, you know, I'm calling that crowdsourced video description. Video description being sort of the opposite of closed captions, where rather than showing on the screen what people are saying, you say in the audio channel what people are doing. And there's been an industry that's been devoted to developing video description for, 25 years now. But they can't possibly keep up with the video, the videos that are being produced, the DVDs and online streamed stuff, and so we're looking at ways of crowdsourcing video description, and at the same time, sort of democratizing the whole thing in sort of a Wikipedia slash YouTube approach to providing description.
Jim, thanks for the call. I want to ask you something, Josh, about just overcoming challenges in life. And I know it's not your favorite thing to talk about how you became blind, because the story itself is a dramatic and terrible one. But I wonder if you would just tell that story briefly, because it leads to, in many ways, sort of the way in which your parents responded to that, and then into your own series of educational opportunities that have taken you to this place today where you're making such a difference in the lives of so many.
Sure. And the sort of language of overcoming is part of this whole sort of language of disability and independence. And so I think overcoming is not really the right way to think of it, so much as just making the right choices and surrounding yourself with, making sure that you have the right people and the right opportunities. And, some of that's choice and some of that's just luck. And so I was born a sighted kid. And when I was 4 years old, I got burned in it was a violent assault. There was our neighbor was a paranoid schizophrenic, and he put sulfuric acid on me when I answered the front door. It's very dramatic and sort of distracting probably from a lot of the other stuff we're talking about. But as you say, I was extremely lucky to have the right family and the right resources available to me. I lived in New York where education for kids with disabilities is quite well funded. I had a family that was able to roll with it, and I had a personality that was able to roll with it. You know, disability is one of the is pretty much the only minority group that anybody can join, and I joined it, and my family was incredible in the opportunities that they were able to provide, and the kind of attitudes that they supported in me and in themselves. I mean, my mom, who's probably listening, hi mom, was an amazing advocate and never told me that there was anything that I couldn't do, and was an incredible ally in, when we would go to museums and, be faced with these inaccessible exhibits, she was the one that would, say, okay, the guard's not looking, now duck under the ropes. And of course, it was incredibly embarrassing. I didn't want to duck under the ropes, but I did want to check out the exhibits. Yeah. And with the encouragement and support of those kinds of parents and family, I was able to benefit from a lot of opportunities. There are very, very few blind people or people with disabilities in general that make it through the educational system to the level that I have. And It's because of ingrained attitudes and lack of access in the educational system. And really, it's much more a problem of the way people perceive disability and disabled people oftentimes perceive themselves, because they don't have the kinds of role models and frameworks of thinking that will lead to success. And so I'm just ridiculously lucky.
And beyond the question of good fortune and the parents you happen to have and the way in which your family and you made certain choices, you suggest it is good luck to have parents in a, who do particular things, but it's also the choices that clearly you made. And the reason why this obviously has additional importance is that there's a tremendous problem with employment of blind people or underemployment of many blind people. And I'm interested in thinking or having you share with us your thoughts on the kind of attitudinal change that has to happen, both for the job seekers, those who are blind, but more importantly, probably for society, so that there is not just a question of luck, that there are more opportunities for people.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's a great point. A lot of it starts with education. The educational system needs to serve blind people and people with other disabilities better. There needs to be one of the huge areas of difficulty is literacy, and people who are totally blind obviously need to be able to take in information. And a lot of the time there's this sort of idea out there that people no longer need Braille because, oh, we have so many cool technologies or somebody can just read it to you. But the truth is that Braille is an essential medium. I would never have been able to get a physics degree or a PhD in psychoacoustics or even get through high school chemistry without Braille. It's an essential medium for taking notes and for writing equations and even just for in other situations. I mean, if you want to read poetry, being able to read it on the page is a big part of reading poetry.
Yeah, you don't necessarily – that's the one where you probably don't want a voice coming out of your smartphone reading, you know, Shakespeare.
So Braille literacy is one of the areas where the educational system really needs to serve people better. There's an interesting statistic out there that and I think we're speaking in round numbers here, but, you know, 70% of people with visual disabilities are unemployed. But 70% of people with visual disabilities who are employed are Braille literate. So Braille really is an important part. And even for people with low vision, it would be helpful. But there's so much sort of reluctance to teach a person with residual vision Braille because it feels to some like admitting defeat. But I sort of reject that approach to it and say it's not admitting anything. It's basically giving people the tools they will need to succeed. So if you're not well educated, you're not going to be able to be well employed, and that's sort of at the root of it.
Number of emails coming in with questions for you, Josh Mealy. Liz writes in, can Dr. Mealy discuss the Diagram Project? And is he also aware of the Bookshare.org library of digitized books?
Bookshare is a really cool project run by a group called Benetech down in the South Bay. And they're a repository for scanned and OCR'd books of all sorts. So basically, if you take a book and scan it on a flatbed scanner, you can run it through some software that will turn it from an image into text. And then you can take those files of the text and upload them to Bookshare's repository. And then anybody else who wants access to that book doesn't need to go through the hassle of scanning it. And this is all legal because of some copyright laws that allow blind people to basically do whatever it is they need to do to get access to books. Bookshare is a great example of the kind of crowdsourcing of accessible information that I think is really sort of the next phase of information accessibility.
Here's an intriguing question from Joe, who writes in, my compliments to Dr. Mealy on his outstanding work. Observation is the cornerstone of science, and it's typically assumed quite literally that you need to look at something and then describe those differences. Along those lines, scientists typically like to present their findings visually, probably because their field is so visually oriented. However, I often find that interpretation of data and presentations of concepts is limited by those visual presentations. I'm wondering if Dr. Mealy has a perspective on the different ways a blind scientist interprets data.
Thanks, Joe. Yeah, that's a very insightful question, so to speak. I think that that is another area of information accessibility that I've done some work in. Many others have done work in. The way a blind scientist such as myself represents data is either as a tactile graph or chart that I would print out with a Braille embosser, which is really not that much different from a visual chart or graph. It's just a different medium. But I also use things called auditory displays, where I will take a data set and will create an auditory representation of that data set to figure out where the clusters are or to figure out what the trends are. And that's... There's an environment that I use pretty extensively, and a lot of other engineers and scientists use it as well. It's called MATLAB, and MATLAB provides all sorts of visualization tools in it, but it doesn't provide any auditory representation tools. But they do provide lots of auditory functionalities, lots of sound production and digital signal processing features. So I actually, when I was in graduate school, because I didn't have any way of representing my data, I did create a set of auditory display tools for MATLAB so that I could figure out what I was, you know, what my results were. And I think that the question about sort of different aspects of data sets emerging from different representations is true. But I don't think anybody has really quantified that. And I don't think that anybody has really found a great example of where auditory displays will sort of trump visual displays. There have been lots of people who've tried, though.
And to Barbara, who joins us from Lakeside, Michigan this morning. Barbara, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Barbara, and my sister is blind, and I'd like to buy her a cell phone where she can get text and look at her email. But it doesn't seem that there's anything available like that for the blind, is there?
So we talked quite a bit earlier about the accessibility of iPhones in particular. And, you know, the interesting thing about using an iPhone as a blind person is that it does make it possible to do all of the major things that you would be doing. You can send emails, you can receive emails, you can send texts and even make phone calls. However, the way you have to interact with it is really different from many other of the paradigms around access software and user interfaces. It really is a whole new way of interacting with a piece of technology. So I would say that really the iPhone is the best platform for what you're asking about right now.
And that's because of the voiceover technology?
It's because of voiceover. It's built in. But you also have to be willing to learn how to use it. And that will take, depending on sort of your gadgetiness, that will take a little while. And it is once you learn how to use it, it's really easy. But learning how to use it can take a couple of days.
Barbara, thanks. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Do you want another question?
Yeah,
do you need a particular software to buy with iPhone, or do you just go buy a regular iPhone and then give it to the person and they figure it out?
Just go buy an iPhone, and in the there's a settings, and you can you open up the settings. There's a general settings, and you go in there, and in there is accessibility, and you can turn on the accessibility features in there. You don't need to do anything other than that.
Barbara, thanks for the call. Mark writes in, is Dr. Mealy familiar with Ray Kurzweil's K-Reader, a mobile text-to-speech technology?
Yes. So one of the things that smartphones have Well, let me step back, actually. So OCR that I mentioned earlier is a technology that has been around for many years and was pioneered in many respects by Ray Kurzweil. The idea of being able to take a picture and turn that – a picture of text and turn that into a text representation that can then be spoken with synthesized speech. It's been around for a long time, and it's in concept very cool. And as I said earlier, so often the devil is in the details. OCR is very cool, and it's wonderful, for example, applied as Bookshare has done, where you scan a whole book and then you can use a screen reader or other technology to read through that book and give you random access to the different chapters and pages and stuff. The idea of being able to use a smartphone to take a picture of a menu or a something else is something that is the KNFB reader is one of the implementations. There are a couple of other ones that are out there, and I think conceptually it's very good, but sort of the practicalities often get in the way. There are lighting issues that lead to pretty high rates of error sometimes. Skew, meaning if you don't take a picture straight on, that can sometimes lead to a lot of errors. And then formatting, a menu that might look good to you as a sighted person might be very difficult to present with speech, because let's say it's in a three-column format where the name of the food is on, in the left column, and the description is in the middle column, and the price is in the right. Communicating to your device that actually you want to read straight across the columns as opposed to column right. one, column two, right. column three. So formatting often gets in the way. And so the conceptually, OCR and portable OCR is really cool, but it is always a presentation problem. Like once you take that picture, how do you structure that information so it's actually going to be useful? And frankly, the percentage of times when it's not useful is too high to make most people want to use it.
Give me an example, Josh Mealy, of something that a technology that you'd love to have that isn't there yet.
Oh, man. I think I'm working on several of them, but they're not there yet. I think that really ready access to all levels of transit information would be really powerful. For example, one of the things that's still really difficult to do in an accessible way is to do automated trip planning, such as you would see on Google Trips or 511.org. Most of this information is presented visually, and even though it is, as we said earlier, spatial information, figuring out how properly to present that and how properly to make trip planning information accessible is a difficult problem, and probably an expensive problem as well. That's one of the things that just comes to me off the top of my head. I think I'll think about that a little bit more.
Okay. Let's get in one more call before we have to wrap things up. Richard in Oakland, just a brief comment or question, please.
Yeah, I was teaching and placing teachers in Poland for 11 years, and Gdańsk had an innovation at street corners where the street crossing signal was a little tune, and a little tune different at each street corner and different in each direction when you wanted to walk. And people really knew what they were, which way to go.
Yeah.
Richard, thanks.
Thank you, Richard. There are a number of countries that have done that. Japan is perhaps the most famous example. Accessible street crossings is one of the big issues. San Francisco has done a really neat job of putting in consistent accessible street accessible pedestrian signals where you have a signal locator that tells you where the button is, and then the button gives you vibrotactile and audio information about when the street crossing, you know, the status of the street crossing signal. And we'll also tell you which street you're, which street is has the signal at the moment. The approach of doing lots of little tunes for lots of places sort of is a it has a certain aesthetic to it, which is charming, but perhaps I think consistency and uniformity has a surprisingly important role to play. You actually, it would be better, I think more effective, to use speech to tell people what street they're at, and as we're doing here in San Francisco. The tunes are sweet, but if you want to, I mean, basically you have to, it's making up a whole new code for the street crossings or the intersections. And why make up a new code when we have a fabulous one already called language?
Here's one last email I'll read as we bring our program to a close. This listener writes in, here's an anecdote about Josh that I don't think Josh will mind sharing about the difference the next generation's view of blindness and disability is. Josh's 6-year-old was at the farmer's market with Josh and her 8-year-old brother. A clown was having a contest and the family was participating. Josh's daughter had a word of caution for the clown. You'd better be careful. My dad's a scientist. Josh Wheatley has been our guest this hour. Thank you for all your work as a scientist and the difference that you're making here in the Bay Area.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure to have you on our program. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.